happy to hear argument in our third case, 12-1252, Ely versus Pinkerton. Mr. Ames?
May it please the court, I am Robert G. Ames, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Pinkerton Government Services, Inc. This court granted appellant's Rule 23F petition for permission to appeal the district court's order granting class certification of appellee's Maryland wage and hour law claim alleging Pinkerton failed to pay security guards whom it employed to provide security services at Andrews Air Force Base for time spent downloading or disarming their weapons from December of 2007 to November of 2009, and for their meal periods, which the appellees claim were on duty and thus compensable pursuant to the Maryland wage and hour law. Appellant's Rule 23F petition asked the court to exercise the discretion afforded it by the Supreme Court in Swint and acknowledged by this court in Rux versus Republic of Sudan to review issues that are otherwise not subject to immediate appeal where such issues are so interconnected or, as the Swint court characterized it, inextricably intertwined with immediately appealable issues that they warrant concurrent review. The appellant submits that under Swint and Rux, the question whether Maryland law should apply to work performed on a federal enclave is inextricably intertwined with and necessary to ensure meaningful review of the district court's class certification order in this case. This inextricable interconnection between the district court's certification order and its previous ruling on whether Maryland wage and hour law applies on the federal enclave that is Andrews Air Force Base, now Joint Base Andrews, is firmly established by the evidence and the arguments which the appellees advance in support of class certification of their meal period claim, and that portion of the district court's oral opinion explaining its certification of that claim.
Well, you make your federal enclave claim as a separate claim in front of us, asserting that we should exercise pendant appellate jurisdiction over.
Yes, Your Honor.
And yet you've just said what sort of occurred to me in preparing for the oral argument, that you might have been better advised to say that because this all took place on a federal enclave and there is no provision in federal law permitting the application of state law here, this is a defense to any claim that Ely would bring. Then you wouldn't have had this problem of having us exercise pendant appellate jurisdiction, which we are very, very loath to do.
Well,
but you didn't do that, did you?
We didn't state it in exactly those words, Your Honor. I'd like to think that we preserved our ability to assert that position because it seemed to us to be evident.
In other words, the gist of what you're saying is that Maryland law doesn't apply, federal law applies here. And, of course, if you're right on that, you're out of it. You don't have to worry about class certification. You don't have to worry about whether there's been an appropriate class certification here. You don't have to deal with any of that. And you're saying, look, court, that's what we should win on. And you asked the district court if you could take an interlocutory appeal to that. And
twice. The last time at the oral argument.
Did you ever ask
argument.
Us?
Pardon?
Did you ever ask us?
No, we didn't.
I didn't think so. Yeah.
Well, if we bought your position, wouldn't we be given an advisory opinion on the federal enclave issue?
I don't think so, Judge Floyd. It seems to me that you would be giving a very important decision on what is sure to be now, in light of the split that has emerged within the U.S. District Court in Maryland, a recurring question of considerable importance in this circuit, given the substantial number of federal enclaves throughout the circuit. It would be my position that this court's decision on whether or not the Service Contract Act did provide the explicit authorization necessary to apply Maryland law, wage and hour law, on the federal enclave would not be advisory at all. It would be a decision on the merits with precedent in this circuit.
Well, the only way, I frankly don't think that, this case presents a, I speak only for myself, an opportunity to exercise a pendant jurisdiction under our precedent. I just don't think that that's there. So it seems to me that the only way that we would reach it is if we would say that your argument about federal enclave is correct, and therefore there is no commonality. Now, you haven't made that argument, though.
So we would be taking an argument you've made and fitting it in to the class action framework.
Your Honor, the Lorazepam decision relied upon by the appellees clearly indicates that it is sometime appropriate under a Rule 23F analysis or a review to look at issues like statute of limitations or the elements of a cause of the elements of the cause of the action in connection with the review of the class certification order. And because we believe that
Did you ask us to do that, though?
Well, we clearly asked this court to take pendent appellate jurisdiction over this issue of the applicability of Maryland law here. And we did that because, again, we submit that that decision is inseparable from the court's application of a novel interpretation of that law to reach its class certification decision here, both for primarily for the meal period class, but certainly for both classes. And again, one couldn't have happened without the other. The fact that we moved early on in the litigation for summary judgment certainly indicates that we viewed it as a defense to these claims and would hope, therefore, that this court would exercise some flexibility with regard to considering our argument here, and that this is an issue that's inextricably intertwined with what the district court did here.
We didn't buy that argument in Rooks versus Republic of Sudan, there were separate issues, and they were trying to get us to get rid of the case on standing, yet there were other things out there that needed to be fleshed out.
What makes this case different is that appellees repeatedly have insisted that the Maryland wage and hour law is even more liberal than the FLSA in defining compensable work time.
Well, they're correct about that, aren't they?
No, we don't believe they are correct.
What difference does it make to you whether we exercise pendant appellate jurisdiction or not?
Well,
because you're going to win on the merits, right?
We certainly are going to win on the merits, but again, we say this question can't be avoided. Indeed, the interconnection here is repeatedly conceded by the appellees in their brief to this court, wherein they argue that the district court's Rule 23 findings as to commonality, typicality, and predominance are the material elements of the Maryland law claim, that the Pinkerton's evidence from the 31 declarants is not material to the legal standard, and the commonality, typicality, and predominance of the claims must be judged against the Maryland standard that the claim invokes. Applicability of the Maryland law and this interpretation of the Maryland law that leads to this class certification order are inseparable, intertwined. Now, again, we understand that you have discretion to exercise pendant appellate jurisdiction if there is the significant or sufficient interconnection. We believe that's the case, and again, we believe that once that interconnection has been established, this court, even though the exercise of that discretion is very infrequent, certainly has the ability to consider judicial economy here. Why should this case be tried to a conclusion and then back before this court ultimately with respect to this very important issue? And certainly, as I said, it's this split that exists now as to the applicability of Maryland wage and hour law on a federal enclave is sure to be spread to other states and their wage and hour laws across the circuit. And it is, as I said, a matter of recurring nature, most likely, of considerable importance.
Okay, well, if we look at SWINT as interpreted in RUCS, okay? So under the elements of SWINT, jurisdiction is appropriate where the issues are, one, so intertwined that we must decide the pendant issue in order to review the claims properly raised on interlocutory appeal, or two, resolution of the issue properly raised on interlocutory appeal necessarily resolves the pendant issue. Which one of those categories do you think you're in?
We think.
I mean, I'm not being rude.
We think it's both, and you know the.
You're
the,
in both.
The problem here, Your Honor, is that there are no plethora of cases out there explains what is inextricably intertwined.
Well,
we believe we
issue.
Have
the
it
second
here.
One is resolution of the issue raised under interlocutory appeal. That's the class action issue. Necessarily resolves the pendant issue. You're clearly not there, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay, so you have to be within the first category to get us to exercise pendant appellate jurisdiction. So intertwined that we must decide the pendant issue. The pendant issue is the whether this is a federal enclave and therefore Maryland law doesn't apply. In order to review the claims properly raised on the interlocutory appeal. I'm not understanding how we would have to decide the pendant issue in order to resolve the claims decided on interlocutory appeal. So help me with that. The issues properly raised whether the class certification was proper.
Again, this class certification is based on a novel interpretation of Maryland law we submit. And the judge couldn't get to considering whether that should be applied here in this case and take the action that he did, which materially affected the class certification decision by his decision to disregard the evidence that Pinkerton provided from the 31 declarants. Couldn't do that absent his prior decision that the Maryland law was applicable here. We continue to believe that they're inextricably interconnected, Your Honor.
So without reaching that pendant issue, you're saying that we also can't decide whether this class could have been certified or not?
Well, we would think that meaningful review of this class certification decision and its application of this unique or novel interpretation of Maryland law would certainly require this court to review whether the Maryland law was applicable in the first place. Yes, Your Honor. Now, moving on, assuming this court were to exercise pendant appellate jurisdiction over this issue, as we've indicated in our briefings, we strongly believe that the federal enclave clause should have been applied here to find that there wasn't the sufficient clear and unambiguous authorization within the Service Contract Act to allow application of Maryland law in this case. And, you know, we would submit that there's nothing in the provisions of the law relied upon by the district court to support its contrary conclusion, certainly not its only reasonable inference theory that it applied here to reach its decision.
Judge, what if we didn't exercise the pendant jurisdiction? What, if any, argument do you have that this class was not properly certified?
No. Alternatively, as you know, Your Honor, we argued that the district court's class certification order should be reversed because the district court abused its discretion in finding the appellee's claims demonstrated the requisite level of commonality, typicality, and predominance. As to the disarming claim in particular, the appellee's claim that they were regularly required to spend time disarming that was not compensated, despite its acknowledgement that the appellant countered that claim with evidence that a number of other people may or may not have been compensated for time spent disarming. The court found that did not change its view that a class action was appropriate on disarming. We have that language from the court. If you have individuals in the potential class of 150 more or less who say that they were all compensated, then they're not going to be compensated for that component, simple enough. The appellant submits that that finding and the district court's ultimate holding certifying the disarming class is not compatible with the holding in Walmart that to establish the requisite commonality, the class must be found to have suffered the same injury, here a failure to receive pay for time spent disarming. What the judges conceded here, in effect through that decision that some people may have been compensated, is that they're going to have to be a daunting number of individualized determinations to determine whether or not there was in fact any violation of the law with respect to disarming. This isn't a donning and doffing case where the issue is whether or not donning and doffing is compensable or not. There's no argument over whether disarming is compensable here. The question is, did people stay beyond their shifts and not be paid for the time that they stayed beyond their shifts? So, I mean, even if it was proven that Plaintiff Ely was not paid for time spent disarming on January 1, 2008, that doesn't answer the question whether all guards who worked that same day on his same shift but at different gates were not paid for all time which they spent disarming that day. And it would not answer the question whether all guards who worked that day on either of the two other possible shifts at any of the three gates at the base were not paid for the time they spent disarming. And the answer to those questions tells us nothing about whether any guards were not paid for disarming on any other single day in this period, December 2007 through November 2009. So we submit that this substantial number of individualized determination renders, certainly demonstrates that there's no common injury for this class and certainly no ability to resolve in one swoop the truth or falsity of the question of failure to pay for disarming, but it renders this class with respect to the disarming totally unmanageable as a class, consistent with this court's prior holdings in Broussard and in Wyndham v. American Brands. I see I'm out of time. I'll have to use my rebuttal time to address the meal period issue further.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Michael Anderson for the plaintiffs. I'll begin with the appealability of the federal enclave issue. The federal enclave defense is raised as an affirmative defense. It is an absolute bar to recovery. They're not saying that the plaintiffs have any wage payment collection right under a general statute, under state common law, and they don't admit that there's any federal common law right to assert wage payment. The only federal wage statute that's even in play here that gives a private cause of action is the FLSA. But as employers are fond of pointing out in every other case, the FLSA is not a general wage collection statute. It only provides standards for a minimum wage and for an overtime premium over 40 hours. And in this case, one of the reasons why the Maryland wage claim is so important is that the security guards are making well over $7.25 an hour. So by being effectively denied pay for their lunch periods or their disarming time, their effective hourly rate over the course of a payroll period is not being pressed below $7.25 an hour. They have no minimum wage claim. And for any workers who are not working a full 40 hours in a pay period, the fact that they have been denied pay for disarming time and for meal periods doesn't make any difference to the FLSA because they are not being deprived of the time and a half premium that only kicks in over 40 hours. That is why the Maryland meal period claim is so important here, because it is the only remedy that plaintiffs have where they have a private cause of action.
Well,
Yes.
I take your point. Mm-hmm. Let's accept that point.
Okay, good.
And,
so,
but let me ask you this question. If we assume for purposes of our argument here that you're correct on that point, then you're correct that they that only if Maryland law applies do they have a right to any relief or right to bring class action. So if the mm-hmm. district court was wrong and Maryland law doesn't apply, mm-hmm. then there's no purpose in certifying a class, right?
No, but there is.
Okay.
But there is.
Tell me about that.
Because the affirmative defense does not question commonality. And as Rule 23 is
current... What authority do you have for that?
Simply for the fact that Pinkerton itself says that the affirmative defense operates absolutely against every member of the class.
It can do two things.
Sorry?
It can do two things.
Well, yeah, but Rule 23 does not make likelihood of success on the merits a prerequisite for certification of the class. Right.
To be sure, but there are some things that would get you out of a merits determination that would also be counted for class action purposes.
No, in fact, I think the best authority on this...
Go read your class action cases. There are things, there are features, perhaps this isn't one of them.
Sure.
That overlap.
Right.
They this count in for whether there's a determination for class action, whether it's proper class action, and would also let you succeed one way or the other on the merits.
Right. This is not an overlap, because as the Walmart court defines an appropriate class action, this is a case where the liability or lack of liability of the defendant to the class can be resolved at a single stroke, with you know, across the board with no variations among the class members. And if Pinkerton ends up prevailing at the appropriate point, either in the district court or on appeal, on its federal enclave defense, there aren't going to be different outcomes as to different class members. All class members lose in common. And it was actually, Your Honor, it was your opinion in Gunnels versus Health Plan that made this point, because in that case, the defendant health plan said, you shouldn't certify a class in this case because we have a powerful and meritorious defense against the entire class. And this court said through Judge Motz that that doesn't matter, that if the defendant really believes that it has a valid defense against the entire class in common, it should welcome class certification.
There had been no determination of that defense. Now there is a determination with respect to the defense, right?
Well, that's true, but it's an interlocutory denial of summary judgment, something that clearly would not be appealable.
What if the district court had certified it for interlocutory appeal? Where would we be then?
Well, you wouldn't have to worry about pendant appellate jurisdiction. That's right.
Believe me, I got it.
Yes, okay. Then you would have received it as a 1292B matter. That's right.
And where would we be on the case?
Okay, well, I would love to get to the merits of the federal enclave if you'd like. At the point that this court has jurisdiction to reach the federal enclave defense, the plaintiffs will win. And we begin with the Air Force contract in this case. The Air Force contract specifically refers to to Pinkerton's duty to observe the meal break laws that are defined by state and local law. And elsewhere in the contract, it says in bold letters and underline, federal immunity from state regulation is not applicable. And this is a note to a comment that says...
And this is the argument that you made to the district court, right?
Yes.
And the district court accepted it?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Now,
I don't think you have to go further.
All right. I just want to point out that what Pinkerton is doing with the federal enclave defense, they are not so much opposing the plaintiffs as defying the Air Force to say that that provision in the Air Force contract is unenforceable because somehow the federal enclave clause deprives the Air Force of the ability to enter into that kind of a contract.
Well, there seems to be some validity to that argument. But go on.
Right, but when you look to the clear and unambiguous congressional authorization, you are not looking to whether there is a specific provision in the Surface Service Contract Act that says state and local meal break laws shall apply on a federal enclave. What you look to is the clear and unambiguous overall purpose of the Service Contract Act, which is to establish parity between federal contractors, including those on a federal enclave, with those in the surrounding civilian area. Now, Pinkerton doesn't deny that the Service Contract Act operates at Andrews Air Force Base, but what they're saying is we may have to pay the same number of dollars per hour that our competitors do elsewhere in Prince George's County, but we don't have to abide by the same Maryland law standards that determine what hours are compensable. And if the court accepts that argument, then the clear and unambiguous purpose of the Service Contract Act has been frustrated. Now, you don't need to decide the very interesting issue of whether the Service Contract Act would create state jurisdiction over federal enclaves in every case. We've cited cases like LeBron Diaz, where Judge Ponsor said that that is so, and we would defend that argument. But you wouldn't need to reach it here, because all we need to do is come up with the requisite authorization for the Air Force to have required this in its contract with Pinkerton, which it plainly did.
Mr. Anderson, I think I got you off on the federal enclave, and maybe you want to be.
I will now proceed to the merits of the
merit in front of us.
I'm sorry.
Since you assert that's not even properly here, maybe you want to go.
Right,
to the argument,
but I have a duty. I have a duty to my clients to make sure that you understand that we do not lie down and concede the federal enclave defense. Turning to the commonality, predominance, and typicality of the Maryland meal period claim, which is the primary claim that we assert here. We do not make our case for certification out of the anecdotal affidavits of named class members. Our case for class certification comes from the deposition testimony of Pinkerton's highest supervisors in articulating the uniform policies that apply at Andrews Air Force Base to Pinkerton guards. In our view, the claim for compensability under Maryland law is made out by the undisputed testimony of those supervisors that when you take a meal period, you have to do it in the guard shack. The guard shack is not a break room. The chief of Pinkerton's security guards was emphatic that this was their post. Guards spend half of their paid working time in the guard shack doing nothing any different, simply waiting with a gun on their hip, with a radio next to them, waiting for a call to be called away. The way that the testimony plays out is that security guards at Andrews spend half an hour at the gate checking IDs of people who come in, and then another half an hour on what's called rotation duty inside the shack. So about 4 hours in 30-minute periods is spent on rotation duty. This is not break time. This is paid work time.
Is there only one class certified here? There aren't any subclasses?
There is a subclass on the disarming claim. And the reason why that's a subclass is that it only covers workers who were employed before November of 2009. But there's no subclass as to the meal period claim.
So, but the disarming claim and the meal claim are together in one class?
I would say that the disarming claim goes to a subclass, a subset of those who are part of the overall meal period class.
Mm-hmm. So what?
What's
the commonality between the meal period class and the disarming class if they're overlapping?
Well, I guess you could call them two separate classes. It's just that their identities, I mean, they are linked by the fact that they're all Pinkerton employees. The commonality that defines the meal period class is that every single guard, no matter how often they testify that they were called away for an emergency, is required to be in the guard shack or smoking a cigarette immediately outside. That's the furthest the testimony will allow them to go. They have to be in or around the guard shack with a gun on their hip, alert, listening to the radio. Now, granted, we concede that during that 45-minute period that's designated as a meal period, they are allowed to do what they please within the confines of the guard shack. That is, they can eat a sandwich or read a magazine. I should point out that it's not like there are televisions and billiard tables it's not a recreational area. It is a work area. But under Maryland law, that's no different than telling an office worker that you are allowed to sit at your desk and eat a sandwich for 45 minutes, and if you get a phone call, you have to take it, and you have to interrupt your lunchtime, but otherwise that's considered to be your meal period. Now, in Maryland, that is compensable.
Can I ask you?
Yes.
We have, since Gunnels and since a lot of the other opinions, on class action, we have the Supreme Court's opinion in Walmart.
Yes.
And the Supreme Court made a great deal of the fact that the district court may only certify a class if it is satisfied under a rigorous analysis that the requirements of Rule 23 are met.
Yes.
Where do we find that rigorous analysis here?
Well, the rigorous analysis is satisfied by the fact that Pinkerton admits, its own supervisors admit, that every single security guard is subject to the conditions I just outlined in, during their unpaid meal period. And then we take you through Maryland law to show you that that defines...
You may take us through. You may do whatever you want. I want you to point to me the pages in the JA where you say that the district court engaged in a rigorous analysis before certifying the class.
Well, the district court gave a bench decision at the close of the argument that lasted about 15 minutes. And I do wish that the district court had issued a written opinion. But your review of the district court, your review of the district court is governed by the same principle that you can affirm the district court on alternative grounds,
well,
even
I'm
those
not... sure after Walmart. The Supreme Court seems to me is speaking loud and clear about the district court making a rigorous analysis.
Well, then your remedy would be to remand to the district court to write up the written decision that we talked about. And I don't think that that serves the parties here. That would not be
a
basis.
That's what a bunch of our sister circuits have done, haven't they?
No, but a lot of circuits...
Exactly this situation.
Right, but a lot of circuits after Walmart have affirmed class actions on the same basis.
Well, because there's been a rigorous analysis.
Well, Your Honor...
You're all but conceding to me that there wasn't one here.
What Judge Massett...
Maybe if you have to go through a rigorous analysis, you can't certify. We don't know, because no one's done it.
Well, I think I've done it in the briefs, and that's exactly the argument I made to Judge Massetti, and Judge Massetti essentially incorporated the argument that was given to him.
Does he say that?
Yes.
He says, I incorporate the arguments that you've
made. I can't quote him saying that, no, but he is speaking at the end of a two-hour argument where all of this analysis...
I thought it was a 15-minute
argument. Sorry?
I thought you said it was 15 minutes.
No, it was a 15-minute oral statement of decision from the bench after a two-hour argument. But I do want to get to Walmart, because the plaintiffs in this case vigorously embrace Walmart, because it speaks to exactly what's wrong with what Pinkerton has done in order to disrupt commonality. What Walmart is basically about is the Supreme Court objecting to parties in class certification cases using expert testimony to smuggle in standards of compensability or of liability that are at odds with the prevailing legal standard. And what happened in Walmart was the plaintiffs brought in expert witnesses who testified in very vague and fuzzy terms about a culture of sex discrimination at Walmart, which was based on anecdotal reports from declarations and depositions from class members. And that analysis had nothing to do with the rigorous bright line definition of sex discrimination under Title VII law. But this case shows why employer defendants can be as guilty of that kind of practice in the use of expert testimony as plaintiffs can. Because what's happened here is that Pinkerton has come in with an expert who has analyzed employee declarations to say there is a wide variation in the reports of class members about how often they are called away. Some claim that they are called away 80% of the time, some 50%, some hardly ever, some 10%. And if the standard of compensability in Maryland depended on that, depended on how often you were actually called away, that would be a powerful argument. But that's not the standard in Maryland. The standard is that if you're forced to sit at your workstation waiting for a call, the time is compensable whether the call comes once a week, once a day, or once a year. It's still compensable time because your personal freedom has been curtailed to that extent. So we embrace Walmart to say that you should reject expert testimony that analyzes the record in a way that's not tethered to the actual legal standard of liability here. And if you apply the actual legal standard of liability, most of what what Pinkerton's expert analyzes is beside the point. Because in our view, all that matters under Maryland is that guards were forced to wait at their workstation They're allowed to eat a sandwich, but they're subject to being called, and that makes it compensable whether they are actually called away 10% or 50% of the time. Those variations are not material. And on that basis, we would say that Walmart dictates that Pinkerton's expert report be discounted because it has nothing to do with the actual standard of compensability. And finally, I'll turn to the disarming time if there's no further questions on that. In a nutshell, the reason why there is commonality on the disarming claim is that before November of 2009, Pinkerton decreed that your work shift ended on the hour. For instance, the graveyard shift gets off. The graveyard shift is changed at 5 a.m. That is when the van comes to bring the relief shift and picks up the guards who are leaving. And all of the declarations confirm that it takes an additional 15 minutes, more or less, to be driven back in the van to you know, take off your weapon and to sign it out with the Air Force. Everybody agrees that there's this 15-minute period after the top of the hour that involves disarming. But before November of 2009, its own supervisors concede that Pinkerton said that your paid shift ends on the hour, which is just another way of saying that we don't regard your disarming time as something you get paid for. Now, in response to that basic claim of commonality based on the supervisor's own testimony, Pinkerton comes back with declarations that were all gathered in June of 2011. They are all worded in the present tense, where workers describe why, you know, I get picked up by my van and my shift ends at 5:15. And that's true. That is true now. And that is why we don't have a disarming claim after November of 2009. But before November of 2009, the official policy decision of Pinkerton was you are not entitled to pay for your disarming period because they said that your shift ends on the hour. And it is flagrantly unfair for Pinkerton to say, well, our guards say in declarations that they have always been paid for all time worked, when the guards had been told by Pinkerton that their work time, at least up until November 2009, ends at the top of the hour, that it's only when those security guards who are not lawyers have the bravery to go find lawyers that can advise them about what donning and doffing time really means under the law, that they can begin to assert that this is in fact time that is compensable. And it's no accident that Pinkerton changed changed the shifts to end at 15 minutes after the hour in November of 2009, immediately after my clients began raising questions about whether disarming time was compensable in the first place. There is no testimony in the declarations that any worker before November of 2009 was routinely allowed to claim this 15-minute period as part of their work shift. In fact, the fact that Pinkerton changed the shift end from the top of the hour to 15 minutes after the hour in November of 2009 is mute testimony that they needed to clean up their act. Their policy before November of 2009 was illegal as to all workers on all shifts, and that's where the commonality lies.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I respectfully disagree with my colleague's assessment of the record here. And let me first say also, 8 pages of transcript, not 8 pages of detailed written opinion. There was no rigorous analysis that was performed with respect to the classes.
Of course, you could have an oral thorough analysis. You wouldn't have to have a written opinion.
You wouldn't have to have a written opinion, but we believe that Walmart would certainly require something more than we have in this case to understand what analysis was performed, especially with respect to the declarant's evidence and why that evidence was disregarded. Just with respect to disarming, there is no Pinkerton official policy not to pay people for disarming. The appellees did not establish that. The record shows that Pinkerton had a written policy in the hands of all of its employees to pay them for the time work. There's declarations that say that if I work beyond the end of my shift, I could tell my supervisor that and get paid for it. And that's why we don't have a common injury here with respect to this disarming issue. There is no common policy. Now, with respect to the meal period, the Maryland law should be read in harmony with the FLSA rather than this novel interpretation that the appellees put forward. The majority view in the U.S. District Court of Maryland is to the effect that the Maryland wage and hour law is the state parallel to the FLSA, and the requirements for pleading a claim under the Maryland wage and hour law mirror those of the federal law. So in Maryland, the proper interpretation of the FLSA is that adopted by this circuit, and whether a meal period is compensable under the FLSA, and therefore absent clear authority to the contrary, under the Maryland wage and hour law as well, is determined by the predominant benefit test, which this court adopted in the Roy v. County of Lexington case, which is whether on balance employees use mealtime for their own or their employees' benefit. Judge Massetti ignored that test, and it appears that he certainly relied rather on the completely relieved from duty test, which this court has overruled. As a result of that, there was no rigorous analysis by the district court of whether the 31 declarations and expert statistical analysis presented common questions of fact as to whether on balance employees use their meal period for their own benefit or the employer's benefit. And as important, there was no rigorous analysis as well as to whether the guards use their meal period, use of it varied based on the gates that they were assigned to and their respective shift at the gates. And there's abundant evidence to show there were three separate gates here that had varying levels of traffic that went through them, varying purposes, that varied by the shifts. There was no analysis as to whether the meal period class might have been limited not to the 152 employees who worked there, but perhaps to some subclass of people who worked at a particular gate on a particular shift. Again, we have none of that in the opinion that's before you.
Thank you very much. We will come down and greet the lawyers and then go directly to our last case.